I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. The history of book banning is interesting enough, but in his new book out today, Ira Wells takes a fascinating survey of literary censorship through the ages and looks at the current efforts to ban books both emanating from the right as well as the left. Libraries are seen by a lot of people as sites of contagion and exposure, and the front line as to what affects children's minds. And so, activists want to suppress opposing viewpoints in the pursuit of their ideological ideas. The arguments range from certain books causing harm because they promote social deviance, or harm can be had through racist language or non-inclusive narratives. The book opens with Mr. Wells, who joins me now, attending a public meeting regarding the books in his children's school library. The librarian there wanted to do away with books that were written prior to 2008. I'll ask Ira about the survey that happened and why a greater role for parents should be played in the schools and libraries where their children learn. Ira Wells is a critic, essayist, and an associate professor at Victoria College and the University of Toronto, where he teaches in the Northrop Frye stream in literature and the humanities. His writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Globe and Mail, Guardian, and The New Republic, among many other publications. He was first on the program back in 2021 when his acclaimed biography, Norman Jewison, A Director's Life, was published. On Book Banning is published by Biblioasis. We spoke in late January. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Ira Wells. Professor Wells, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So it is true, I guess, Ira, isn't it, and it's not just a bad feeling that a lot of us are having, that there is a rise in book banning, isn't there?
That's right. The organization that really tracks this information is PEN. It's poets, essayists, novelists, and PEN has identified more than 10,000 instances in the last year of books being removed from schools. That's in the U.S. We can talk about the Canadian context too. But I would quickly say on this that one well-known study conducted by the American Library Association estimated that between 82 and 97% of all library challenges go unreported. Mm. So when Penn is saying that there's 10,000 that they've noticed, and the ALA is saying that 97% of them go unreported, you can bet that there's a lot of book challenges happening.
So when I go to the Vancouver Public Library website, there's a place there that if I want to suggest a book for them to put in the system, or a DVD or whatever, I can put that in. I don't know what the situation is in Ontario in the libraries that you're near, but Are challenges handled the same way? I mean, are they as easy to put into the system as say, a recommendation even?
Yeah, so most public libraries have processes for challenging materials. They also have material selection processes that are transparent, so you should be able to fairly easily get an understanding of how libraries are using the public money to mm-hmm. acquire particular texts. And if you think that, you know, your political viewpoint isn't being represented, then you can use that feature that you just described, the request a book. And so this, you know, I was doing a bit of research on this in Toronto, and it turned out that during the pandemic, the Toronto Public Library System did not have the RFK book about how Anthony Fauci was mm-hmm. Some would say a conspiratorial
right.
book. The Toronto Public Library didn't have it, and somebody requested it, and you can look now, and you can see that the library has like 11 or 12 copies. So my sense is that, and having spoken to librarians, that they are interested in having the books in their system that people want, and there's very little, you know, policing of those books from the perspective of ideology, or, you know, as one librarian told me, like, if the Trump books are moving through the system, we'll get more Trump books.
Mm.
They want to serve their population.
We'll talk about the right wing or you know, Christian fundamentalists and their role, and you know, you write about that in the book through the context of what's happening in Florida. I want to give an example of how progressives are how they do book censorship, if you will. Because early on in the book, you talk about the Alice Munro situation from last year, where right after her daughter's story was revealed publicly, how people attached, as you call it in the book, moral value to Monroe's work. And, you know, we all saw those photos on social media of people throwing away their Alice Monroe books. I remember in the summer seeing it used book sales or garage sales, you know, more Alice Monroe stuff for sale. People wanted to get rid of this stuff. What do you make of what say progressives are doing in the realm of book banning, say?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think I have two things to say on this. The first, on the Alice Monroe situation, is that what really struck me about that last summer is that, I mean, look, we've long been struggling with these questions of how to deal with the art that is produced by artists who do terrible things, mm-hmm. or do things that we are upset by, and we, of course, have many examples of this. We've long struggled with that. What I found interesting about the Alice Monroe case is that there didn't seem to be much struggle at all, that people just seemed to automatically, they went to basically the destruction of those books very quickly. When you saw those images online of people filling their garbage cans of with Alice Monroe books, and I'm not diminishing the sense of horror that we experience when we read about that, right. Alice Monroe situation. Yeah. It's a terrible situation. But the books went from being Nobel Prize-winning books to garbage overnight in the minds of many people, and I think that we should struggle over that and think about that impulse to censor that awoken that produced in us. With regard to progressive censorship more generally, this has been happening in Ontario. There was a case in the fall of 2023. Where the Peel region, which is just east of Toronto, with 257 schools, they engaged in a, quote, equity book weeding process, unquote, in which some schools purged thousands of books as part of this sort of equity review. They insisted this was not censorship. They insist this was not book banning. But I think according to their own definitions, they're rather the definition of censorship provided by their own organization. It, in fact, was censorship, but we can talk more about that if you want.
Yeah, this goes into the example that you give early in the book, is that this went on at your kid's school, and the library at your kid's school, they wanted to, I can't remember the term that they used now, but anything before 2008, is that right? They wanted to get rid of?
That was in the Peel region. At my kid's school, the principal just remarked, so the school had undertaken this thing they called a library audit.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know what that meant. You know, I had been reading a bit about the book banning situation in Florida, uh-huh. For example, and I wondered, like, if this was a sort of cover for censorship that may sure. be happening in Toronto. So I showed up for this library audit that was happening at my kid's school. And the principal of the school just remarked in a very kind of offhanded way, just kind of casually said that if it were up to her, she would just get rid of all the old books. And I was quite struck by that. I wondered if maybe she was joking,
sure.
to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, yeah.
But the next fall, as I say, in Peel region, which is the school board just to the west of us, they in fact purged every book pre-2008 they got rid of, which is kind of astonishing.
Yeah, the other trouble thing is that they couldn't donate the books. They really had to be destroyed, didn't they?
That's right. They had deemed the books that were written prior to 2008, they had deemed them to be harmful,
mm.
and as such, they could not donate them to communities in need. They couldn't send them to other jurisdictions that might have used those books, but instead they boxed them up and sent them to the landfill.
You chronicle the book banning in places like Florida, and I couldn't help, as I was reading that, Ira, think, you know, of all these the bizarre campaigns, you know, aided by people like Ron DeSantis and on down. How this might devolve over the next 4 years, not just in the United States but elsewhere. I mean, we are heading into troubling times, aren't we?
I'd say so. Where we're heading. So the book, as I was finishing writing the book just during the U.S. Federal election, and I didn't quite know. We had a sort of premonition of what was coming. But already there had been, you know, several years of this quite concerted push to censor books in Florida, remove anything that had to do with race, LGBTQ themes, anything related to sort of sexual matters or sex education. Those books had been under fire for a long time in Florida. And the rationale that they used there was that they needed to save their children from harm. They needed to save their children from these harmful books, and particularly from indoctrination. So I guess the underlying theory here is that if the children are exposed to these LGBTQ-themed books, that they'll be indoctrinated into those into such a worldview or into a lifestyle that the parents don't approve of. I guess, you know, two things really interest me about this. One is that you get the exact same rationale from the progressives in Ontario who want to save children from harm, specifically from harmful Eurocentric representations of the world or patriarchal representations or what have you. But you also get this push in Florida to sort of refuse to accept that what they're doing is censorship. Like they call it a hoax. They say that, and just a couple of days ago, Trump said that he is pushing to end the book banning hoax. But nobody would disagree that they're removing books from Florida libraries. So how can you have this censorship that's ongoing that is also a hoax? But how they get around this is kind of funny, is that they just insist that the books that they're pulling from the shelves aren't books, that they're pornography. Mm. And so, you know, they're just valiantly removing the pornography that has been snuck onto their children's bookshelves. So it's not censorship, it's just getting rid of pornography.
You have to laugh at some of these rhetorical contortions, you know, in their arguments, you know, that banning some books are in line with, say, America's founding principles, yet, you know, they forget at that moment that free speech is, you know, one of those founding principles. I guess the thing that you know, I might laugh reading that, but at the same time, you know, you do point out that, you know, the harms, and I never thought about this until, you know, you point this out in the book, that the children of today are affected in the sense that they're going to accept censorship as, you know, a little bit is okay, or even that censorship itself is given, and it shapes, I guess, how much of it they take for granted, don't they?
Yeah, and this is something that I worry about. I worry about it with my own children. My own children are school-age kids. I worry about it with regard to my students. I'm a university professor. I worry about it with regard to them. And just in society as a whole, is that we're getting quite used to censorship. We're starting to just become acclimatized to this idea that if people say something that you disagree with, well, you know, everything's political, so let's just try and deplatform that person, or let's try and ensure that they can't speak in particular contexts. And one way that people do that is by labeling that kind of speech dangerous or harmful. And, you know, particularly with regard to kids, as you said a minute ago, that, you know, when kids are, as they grow up in the world, part of what censorship is about, part of what book censorship is about in places like Florida, in places like Ontario, is controlling the narratives and the stories that they have access to as they're coming of age. So it is a kind of future-oriented attack, right? Mm. It's sort of like thinking about, like, what kind of a world are we trying to socially engineer here, and can we bring that into effect by policing the kinds of stories that children have access to now? Which is a pretty, you know, it's thought control is what they're after. But I do think that children will internalize the means, that they will come to, they may very well reproduce what the grown-ups have done to them,
right?
And become censors themselves, or simply think that censorship is just part of life, right? And that when governments try to do it, well, you know, it just sort of, it becomes normalized to them. And I do think that's a dangerous thing that we need to be on guard against.
So you we're about the same age, you're a university professor, so you're seeing, you know, people younger than ourselves. You also have children, so you're seeing, you know, another generation, say, of people. Do you see these things firsthand, sort of these trends happening? I mean, like, what is it like for when you're teaching your students, for example, at school? Do you see these things come through?
Well, I'll say this, that about 5 years, let's say 5 years ago, if I'm teaching a first-year university course, I could count on students having read certain books. I could count on them, in a Canadian context, most of them would have read To Kill a Mockingbird, mm-hmm. most of them would have read Lord of the Flies. You know, some may have read, some may have read Huck Finn, that may be a stretch, but certainly they could have read To Kill a Mockingbird, Lord of the Flies.
1984.
1984. Certainly, To Kill a Mockingbird and Lord of the Flies, those books are now actually unteachable in high school, right? They are no longer part of the high school curriculum. They have essentially been, so, you know, some of these books have gone from, like, being mandatory mm-hmm. to being literally unteachable in the space of about 5 years. So that has been a notable change. But I think another notable change is just, and this is, you know, somewhat more depressing for someone who teaches literature for a living as I do, is just the decentering of the book itself from education. So my sense is that high school kids these days get a lot more summaries or chapters of books, that they're not asked to read entire books in the way that previous generations may have been. And so this, you know, this raises another interesting kind of paradox for me, is why are people so worked up about the negative, or why are people so concerned with the harm that books can produce when kids are reading so few books?
Yeah.
And they're spending all their time online, right? You know, surely if we care about the negative effects of media, we would actually pay more attention to the media that the kids are actually consuming, rather than, you know, surveys suggest that kids between the ages 15 and 19 spend about 9 minutes a day reading.
I'm shaking my head here. You highlight in the book literary censorship throughout history. And, you know, times have been polarized before, but at the same time, you know, as I'm reading that, I'm thinking there's a lot we can learn here through the cycles of history. And I guess I bring this up because I want to ask you what you think the future will hold. Are we at an ebb and it'll, you know, things will improve? Or how do you view the next 5-10 years, say, in this regard?
Well, I think we're at an inflection point. And I think it's a complicated question. Let me give you an example. So a couple of years ago, a couple of summers ago, Salman Rushdie, the novelist who was under the Iranian fatwa, was stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
In the days leading up to that stabbing, Rushdie's novels were not on any bestseller lists. They were, you know, he's always probably sold steadily, but after the stabbing, the Satanic Verses and some of other Rushdie's books were suddenly back on the bestseller lists. So attempts to, in that case, censor the author himself out of existence, mm-hmm. right, appallingly and brutally and terribly, had the perverse impact of making his books sell more. And that is that general tendency, I think, plays out fairly frequently when people try to ban books, that it's in fact stimulating of sales. And that certainly is the case in a North American context. But why I think it's important to remember that is that there's a kind of intellectual infrastructure that makes that possible, that we actually have laws protecting expressive freedom. We value expressive freedom. and that that is not just an ironclad rule that we can, you know, it's not the case that censorship actually has this reverse effect everywhere at all times. And there have been cases throughout history where we've simply lost manuscripts, books, mm-hmm. great works of art. More cases than we could, you know, than we even know about. So censorship also, you know, is incredibly destructive. It impoverishes humanity. It destroys lives. It makes us dumber. We lose the ability to think through and know why we think the way we do when we can't think about the counterarguments. But when we're told that certain ideas are just too harmful to contemplate, or that some things are just beyond the pale, and this atrophies, this muscle that we have atrophies. And to answer your question, I do feel like we're kind of at a stage now where we will either recommit to expressive freedom and mm-hmm. relearn these lessons, or we are going to find ourselves in some significant trouble, and I do see that coming.
So the idea of who's in charge or who decides, you know, what's, say, you know, on sale or what's published or, you know, what's available in a library, I mean, you know, that's confounded societies for decades. So do you suggest in the book a remedy for that? I mean, do you have an idea or a sense of how that can be addressed, say?
So this is complicated, and I don't have a simple answer to it, but I just think that some definitional clarity around these issues is important, so that, you know, when a bookstore, for example, decides not to sell a book, mm-hmm. I don't consider that censorship, or when a publisher decides not to publish my book
or cancels a book, yeah, right.
That's not. Yeah. I don't consider that to be censorship, because, you know, these businesses are businesses and they have their own business models, and I don't expect, you know, I don't expect a Christian bookstore to be selling pornography. I don't want, or to, you know, erotica. I wouldn't want to live in a world where you know the government was forcing private enterprises to conduct themselves in ways that are contrary to their own mission, their own values. I think that sort of compelled speech is also an infringement of freedom of speech. But at the same time, when public enterprises like schools are removing books or reducing access, pulling books from shelves because of objectionable content, that is censorship. And they will invoke these rationales like we're saving children from harm, without very closely defining what the harm is or how the harm is happening, but in a way that becomes hard to stand up against without sounding like a bigot, or without sounding as though, you know, I think we've kind of lost the ability to make the arguments for expressive freedom in a public way, which is a challenge for us, but I think we can get over it.
I mean, you suggest at the end of the book about the role that we could play, say, in our own lives or in the lives of other people around us, especially in our homes. You know, how you as a parent might affect what's consumed by the young people in your life. I mean, you know, that's a role that a lot of people perhaps have abandoned, I suppose, in recent years.
Yeah, I think it's, well, you know, I struggle with this, to be honest, in the sense that I wish my own children would read a little more than they do. They are readers, so I'm proud of them. But it's the distractions are endless, right? In our mm-hmm. society, and the temptation to pick up the phone is always the tablet or whatever is always there. But I do think it's important to reproduce these values in the youth, and to sort of leave a trail so that they can pick up the pieces, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that if we course correct, look, there are things that liberal societies have had a terrible track record with, right? We have, you know, sometimes I think we might think that there was some glorious age of free speech, where everyone had, you know, perfect rights of freedom of expression.
Yeah.
And if you do your homework, you'll find out that that's That's not very true, that certain communities have been the subject of terrible prejudice that did not enjoy the same expressive freedom rights as others. And we can reckon with that without, you know, throwing the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. In other words, that if we give up on the freedom of speech as an ideal, right, we will discover that we can become a lot less free.
Yeah. I can't tell you how edifying this book is, and how what a call to action it is in terms of the work that we all have to do in our own lives. I mean, if you are a parent, I'm not a parent, but you do have to play a part in how the library at the kids' school works, right? And that's something that a lot more parents should do, right?
I think so, and also just. You know, the idea behind expressive freedom and free speech is a value, which is fundamentally that everyone should, that you should have the right to say whatever it is that you want, to express your mind, to publish what you want. Not so much just for you, yeah. Although you should have it for you, but also because it's my right to hear what you have to say, right? But that's kind of a counterintuitive idea, the idea that it's in my best interest to have other people get to speak their minds, even if I disagree, right? I don't think that's something that people come to naturally. I do think that they have to be reminded of these arguments, right, about how we owe it to ourselves to hear ideas that we disagree with in order to be able to retrace our own steps, remind ourselves through kind of adversarial thinking. Why do I believe what I believe, right? Mm-hmm. That when we silence people, when we shut people up and don't allow them to speak their minds, we're losing the opportunity to come to terms with our own thinking.
Ira, congratulations on this book. It's been a pleasure speaking again. Continued good luck with it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a great conversation.
The book is called On Book Banning. It's published by Biblioasis. Its author, Ira Wills, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.